20,000 Leagues Under the Seas, An Underwater Tour of the World. First Part, Chapter 1. A Runaway Reef. The year 1866 was marked by a bizarre development, an unexplained and downright inexplicable phenomenon that surely no one has forgotten. Without getting into those rumors that upset civilians in the seaports and deranged the public mind even far inland, it must be said that professional seamen were especially alarmed. Traders, shipowners, captains of vessels, skippers, and master mariners from Europe and America, naval officers from every country, and at their heels the various national governments on these two continents, were all extremely disturbed by the business. In essence, over a period of time several ships had encountered an enormous thing at sea, a long spindle-shaped object, sometimes giving off a phosphorescent glow, infinitely bigger and faster than any whale. The relevant data on this apparition, as recorded in various logbooks, agreed pretty closely as to the structure of the object or creature in question, its unprecedented speed of movement, its startling locomotive power, and the unique vitality with which it seemed to be gifted. If it was a cetacean, it exceeded in bulk any whale previously classified by science. No naturalist, neither Cuvier nor Lacépède, neither Professor Dumeril nor Professor de Quatrefages, would have accepted the existence of such a monster sight unseen, specifically, unseen by their own scientific eyes. Striking an average of observations taken at different times, rejecting those timid estimates that gave the object a length of 200 feet, and ignoring those exaggerated views that saw it as a mile wide and three long, you could still assert that this phenomenal creature greatly exceeded the dimensions of anything then known to ichthyologists, if it existed at all. Now then, it did exist, this was an undeniable fact, and since the human mind dotes on objects of wonder, you can understand the worldwide excitement caused by this unearthly apparition. As for relegating it to the realm of fiction, that charge had to be dropped. In essence, on July 20, 1866, the steamer Governor Higginson, from the Calcutta and Burnage Steam Navigation Company, encountered this moving mass 5 miles off the eastern shores of Australia. Captain Baker at first thought he was in the presence of an unknown reef, he was even about to fix its exact position when two waterspouts shot out of this inexplicable object and sprang hissing into the air some 150 feet. So, unless this reef was subject to the intermittent eruptions of a geyser, the Governor Higginson had fair and honest dealings with some aquatic mammal, until then unknown, that could spurt from its blowholes waterspouts mixed with air and steam. Similar events were likewise observed in Pacific seas, on July 23 of the same year, by the Christopher Columbus from the West India and Pacific Steam Navigation Company. Consequently, this extraordinary cetacean could transfer itself from one locality to another with startling swiftness, since within an interval of just 3 days, the Governor Higginson and the Christopher Columbus had observed it at two positions on the chart separated by a distance of more than 700 nautical leagues. 15 days later and 2,000 leagues farther, the Helvetia from the Compagnie Nationale and the Shannon from the Royal Mail Line, running on opposite tacks in that part of the Atlantic lying between the United States and Europe, respectively signaled each other that the monster had been sighted in latitude 42 degrees 15 north and longitude 60 degrees 35 west of the meridian of Greenwich. From their simultaneous observations, they were able to estimate the mammal's minimum length at more than 350 English feet. This was because both the Shannon and the Helvetia were of smaller dimensions, although each measured 100 meters stem to stern. Now then, the biggest whales, those rorqual whales that frequent the waterways of the Aleutian Islands, have never exceeded a length of 56 meters, if they reach even that. Author's note, about 106 meters. An English foot is only 30.4 centimeters. One after another, reports arrived that would profoundly affect public opinion. New observations taken by the transatlantic liner Pereire, the inman lines Etna running afoul of the monster, an official report drawn up by officers on the French frigate Normandy, dead earnest reckonings obtained by the general staff of Commodore Fitzjames aboard the Lord Clyde. In light-hearted countries, people joked about this phenomenon, but such serious, practical countries as England, America, and Germany were deeply concerned. In every big city the monster was the latest rage, they sang about it in the coffee houses, they ridiculed it in the newspapers, they dramatized it in the theaters. The tabloids found it a fine opportunity for hatching all sorts of hoaxes. In those newspapers short of copy, you saw the reappearance of every gigantic imaginary creature, from Moby Dick, that dreadful white whale from the high Arctic regions, to the stupendous kraken whose tentacles could entwine a 500-ton craft and drag it into the ocean depths. They even reprinted reports from ancient times, the views of Aristotle and Pliny accepting the existence of such monsters, then the Norwegian stories of Bishop Pontoppidan, the narratives of Paul Egede, And finally the reports of Captain Harrington, whose good faith is above suspicion, in which he claims he saw, while aboard the Castilian in 1857, one of those enormous serpents that, until then, had frequented only the seas of France's old extremist newspaper, The Constitutionalist. An interminable debate then broke out between believers and skeptics in the scholarly societies and scientific journals. The monster question inflamed all minds. During this memorable campaign, journalists making a profession of science battled with those making a profession of wit, spilling waves of ink and some of them even two or three drops of blood, since they went from sea serpents to the most offensive personal remarks. For 6 months the war seesawed. With inexhaustible zest, the popular press took potshots at feature articles from the Geographic Institute of Brazil, the Royal Academy of Science in Berlin, the British Association, the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., at discussions in the Indian Archipelago, in Cosmos published by Father Moino, in Petermann's Mittheilungen, and at scientific chronicles in the great French and foreign newspapers. When the monster's detractors cited a saying by the botanist Linnaeus that nature doesn't make leaps, witty writers in the popular periodicals parodied it, maintaining in essence that nature doesn't make lunatics, and ordering their contemporaries never to give the lie to nature by believing in krakens, sea serpents, Moby Dicks, and other all-out efforts from drunken seamen. Finally, in a much-feared satirical journal, an article by its most popular columnist finished off the monster for good, spurning it in the style of Hippolytus repulsing the amorous advances of his stepmother Phaedra, and giving the creature its quietus amid a universal burst of laughter. Wit had defeated science. German, Bulletin. Ed. During the first months of the year 1867, the question seemed to be buried, and it didn't seem due for resurrection, when new facts were brought to the public's attention. But now it was no longer an issue of a scientific problem to be solved, but a quite real and serious danger to be avoided. The question took an entirely new turn. The monster again became an islet, rock, or reef, but a runaway reef, unfixed and elusive. On March 5, 1867, the Moravian from the Montreal Ocean Company, lying during the night in latitude 27 degrees 30 and longitude 72 degrees 15, ran its starboard quarter afoul of a rock marked on no charts of these waterways. Under the combined efforts of wind and 400 horsepower steam, it was traveling at a speed of 13 knots. Without the high quality of its hull, the Moravian would surely have split open from this collision and gone down together with those 237 passengers it was bringing back from Canada. This accident happened around 5 o'clock in the morning, just as day was beginning to break. The officers on watch rushed to the craft's stern. They examined the ocean with the most scrupulous care. They saw nothing except a strong eddy breaking three cable lengths out, as if those sheets of water had been violently churned. The site's exact bearings were taken, and the Moravian continued on course apparently undamaged. Had it run afoul of an underwater rock or the wreckage of some enormous derelict ship? They were unable to say. But when they examined its undersides in the service yard, they discovered that part of its keel had been smashed. This occurrence, extremely serious in itself, might perhaps have been forgotten like so many others, if 3 weeks later it hadn't been reenacted under identical conditions. Only, thanks to the nationality of the ship victimized by this new ramming, and thanks to the reputation of the company to which this ship belonged, the event caused an immense uproar. No one is unaware of the name of that famous English shipowner, Cunard. In 1840 this shrewd industrialist founded a postal service between Liverpool and Halifax, featuring three wooden ships with 400 horsepower paddle wheels and a burden of 1,162 metric tons. 8 years later, the company's assets were increased by four 650 horsepower ships at 1,820 metric tons, and in 2 more years, by two other vessels of still greater power and tonnage. In 1853 the Cunard Company, whose mail-carrying charter had just been renewed, successively added to its assets the Arabia, the Persia, the China, the Scotia, the Java, and the Russia, all ships of top speed and, after the Great Eastern, the biggest ever to plow the seas. So in 1867 this company owned 12 ships, 8 with paddle wheels and 4 with propellers. If I give these highly condensed details, it is so everyone can fully understand the importance of this maritime transportation company, known the world over for its shrewd management. No transoceanic navigational undertaking has been conducted with more ability, no business dealings have been crowned with greater success. In 26 years Cunard ships have made 2,000 Atlantic crossings without so much as a voyage cancelled, a delay recorded, a man, a craft, or even a letter lost. Accordingly, despite strong competition from France, passengers still choose the Cunard line in preference to all others, as can be seen in a recent survey of official documents. Given this, no one will be astonished at the uproar provoked by this accident involving one of its finest steamers. On April 13, 1867, with a smooth sea and a moderate breeze, the Scotia lay in longitude 15 degrees 12 and latitude 45 degrees 37. It was traveling at a speed of 13.43 knots under the thrust of its 1,000 horsepower engines. Its paddle wheels were churning the sea with perfect steadiness. It was then drawing 6.7 meters of water and displacing 6,624 cubic meters. At 4:17 in the afternoon, during a high tea for passengers gathered in the main lounge, a collision occurred, scarcely noticeable on the whole, affecting the Scotia's hull in that quarter a little astern of its port paddle wheel. The Scotia hadn't run afoul of something, it had been fouled, and by a cutting or perforating instrument rather than a blunt one. This encounter seemed so minor that nobody on board would have been disturbed by it, had it not been for the shouts of crewmen in the hold, who climbed on deck yelling, "We're sinking! We're sinking!" At first the passengers were quite frightened, but Captain Anderson hastened to reassure them. In fact, there could be no immediate danger. Divided into seven compartments by watertight bulkheads, the Scotia could brave any leak with impunity. Captain Anderson immediately made his way into the hold. He discovered that the fifth compartment had been invaded by the sea, and the speed of this invasion proved that the leak was considerable. Fortunately, this compartment didn't contain the boilers, because their furnaces would have been abruptly extinguished. Captain Anderson called an immediate halt, and one of his sailors dived down to assess the damage. Within moments they had located a hole 2 meters in width on the steamer's underside. Such a leak could not be patched, and with its paddle wheels half swamped, the Scotia had no choice but to continue its voyage. By then it lay 300 miles from Cape Clear, and after 3 days of delay that filled Liverpool with acute anxiety, it entered the company docks. The engineers then proceeded to inspect the Scotia, which had been put in dry dock. They couldn't believe their eyes. 2.5 meters below its waterline, there gaped a symmetrical gash in the shape of an isosceles triangle. This breach in the sheet iron was so perfectly formed, no punch could have done a cleaner job of it. Consequently, it must have been produced by a perforating tool of uncommon toughness, plus, after being launched with prodigious power and then piercing 4 centimeters of sheet iron, this tool had needed to withdraw itself by a backward motion truly inexplicable. This was the last straw, and it resulted in arousing public passions all over again. Indeed, from this moment on, any maritime casualty without an established cause was charged to the monster's account. This outrageous animal had to shoulder responsibility for all derelict vessels, whose numbers are unfortunately considerable, since out of those 3,000 ships whose losses are recorded annually at the Marine Insurance Bureau, the figure for steam or sailing ships supposedly lost with all hands, in the absence of any news, amounts to at least 200. Now then, justly or unjustly, it was the monster who stood accused of their disappearance, and since, thanks to it, travel between the various continents had become more and more dangerous, the public spoke up and demanded straight out that, at all cost, the seas be purged of this fearsome cetacean. Chapter 2. The Pros and Cons. During the period in which these developments were occurring, I had returned from a scientific undertaking organized to explore the Nebraska Badlands in the United States. In my capacity as assistant professor at the Paris Museum of Natural History, I had been attached to this expedition by the French government. After spending 6 months in Nebraska, I arrived in New York laden with valuable collections near the end of March. My departure for France was set for early May. In the meantime, then, I was busy classifying my mineralogical, botanical, and zoological treasures when that incident took place with the Scotia. I was perfectly abreast of this question, which was the big news of the day, and how could I not have been? I had read and reread every American and European newspaper without being any farther along. This mystery puzzled me. Finding it impossible to form any views, I drifted from one extreme to the other. Something was out there, that much was certain, and any doubting Thomas was invited to place his finger on the Scotia's wound. When I arrived in New York, the question was at the boiling point. The hypothesis of a drifting islet or an elusive reef, put forward by people not quite in their right minds, was completely eliminated. And indeed, unless this reef had an engine in its belly, how could it move about with such prodigious speed? Also discredited was the idea of a floating hull or some other enormous wreckage, and again because of this speed of movement. So only two possible solutions to the question were left, creating two very distinct groups of supporters, on one side, those favoring a monster of colossal strength, on the other, those favoring an underwater boat of tremendous motor power. Now then, although the latter hypothesis was completely admissible, It couldn't stand up to inquiries conducted in both the New World and the Old. That a private individual had such a mechanism at his disposal was less than probable. Where and when had he built it, and how could he have built it in secret? Only some government could own such an engine of destruction, and in these disaster-filled times, when men tax their ingenuity to build increasingly powerful aggressive weapons, it was possible that, unknown to the rest of the world, some nation could have been testing such a fearsome machine. The Chassepot rifle led to the torpedo, and the torpedo has led to this underwater battering ram, which in turn will lead to the world putting its foot down. At least I hope it will. But this hypothesis of a war machine collapsed in the face of formal denials from the various governments. Since the public interest was at stake and transoceanic travel was suffering, the sincerity of these governments could not be doubted. Besides, how could the assembly of this underwater boat have escaped public notice? Keeping a secret under such circumstances would be difficult enough for an individual, and certainly impossible for a nation whose every move is under constant surveillance by rival powers. So, after inquiries conducted in England, France, Russia, Prussia, Spain, Italy, America, and even Turkey, the hypothesis of an underwater monitor was ultimately rejected. And so the monster surfaced again, despite the endless witticisms heaped on it by the popular press, and the human imagination soon got caught up in the most ridiculous ichthyological fantasies. After I arrived in New York, several people did me the honor of consulting me on the phenomenon in question. In France I had published a 2-volume work, in quarto, entitled The Mysteries of the Great Ocean Depths. Well received in scholarly circles, this book had established me as a specialist in this pretty obscure field of natural history. My views were in demand. As long as I could deny the reality of the business, I confined myself to a flat no comment. But soon, pinned to the wall, I had to explain myself straight out. And in this vein, the Honorable Pierre Aronnax, professor at the Paris Museum, was summoned by the New York Herald to formulate his views no matter what. I complied. Since I could no longer hold my tongue, I let it wag. I discussed the question in its every aspect, both political and scientific, and this is an excerpt from the well-padded article I published in the issue of April 30. Therefore, I wrote, after examining these different hypotheses one by one, we are forced, every other supposition having been refuted, to accept the existence of an extremely powerful marine animal. The deepest parts of the ocean are totally unknown to us. No soundings have been able to reach them. What goes on in those distant depths? What creatures inhabit, or could inhabit, those regions 12 or 15 miles beneath the surface of the water? What is the constitution of these animals? It's almost beyond conjecture. However, the solution to this problem submitted to me can take the form of a choice between two alternatives. Either we know every variety of creature populating our planet, or we do not. If we do not know every one of them, if nature still keeps ichthyological secrets from us, nothing is more admissible than to accept the existence of fish or cetaceans of new species or even new genera, animals with a basically cast iron constitution that inhabit strata beyond the reach of our soundings, and which some development or other, an urge or a whim if you prefer, can bring to the upper level of the ocean for long intervals. If, on the other hand, we do know every living species, we must look for the animal in question among those marine creatures already catalogued, and in this event I would be inclined to accept the existence of a giant narwhal. The common narwhal, or sea unicorn, often reaches a length of 60 feet. Increase its dimensions fivefold or even tenfold, then give this cetacean a strength in proportion to its size while enlarging its offensive weapons, and you have the animal we're looking for. It would have the proportions determined by the officers of the Shannon, the instrument needed to perforate the Scotia, and the power to pierce a steamer's hull. In essence, the narwhal is armed with a sort of ivory sword, or lance, as certain naturalists have expressed it. It's a king-sized tooth as hard as steel. Some of these teeth have been found buried in the bodies of baleen whales, which the narwhal attacks with invariable success. Others have been wrenched, not without difficulty, from the undersides of vessels that narwhals have pierced clean through, as a gimlet pierces a wine barrel. The museum at the Faculty of Medicine in Paris owns one of these tusks with a length of 2.25 meters and a width at its base of 48 centimeters. All right then. Imagine this weapon to be 10 times stronger and the animal 10 times more powerful, launch it at a speed of 20 miles per hour, multiply its mass times its velocity, and you get just the collision we need to cause the specified catastrophe. So, until information becomes more abundant, I plump for a sea unicorn of colossal dimensions, no longer armed with a mere lance but with an actual spur, like ironclad frigates or those warships called rams, whose mass and motor power it would possess simultaneously. This inexplicable phenomenon is thus explained away, unless it's something else entirely, which, despite everything that has been cited, studied, explored and experienced, is still possible. These last words were cowardly of me, but as far as I could, I wanted to protect my professorial dignity and not lay myself open to laughter from the Americans, who when they do laugh, laugh raucously. I had left myself a loophole. Yet deep down, I had accepted the existence of the monster. My article was hotly debated, causing a fine old uproar. It rallied a number of supporters. Moreover, the solution it proposed allowed for free play of the imagination. The human mind enjoys impressive visions of unearthly creatures. Now then, the sea is precisely their best medium, the only setting suitable for the breeding and growing of such giants, next to which such land animals as elephants or rhinoceroses are mere dwarves. The liquid masses support the largest known species of mammals and perhaps conceal mollusks of incomparable size or crustaceans too frightful to contemplate, such as 100-meter lobsters or crabs weighing 200 metric tons. Why not? Formerly, in prehistoric days, land animals, quadrupeds, apes, reptiles, birds, were built on a gigantic scale. Our creator cast them using a colossal mold that time has gradually made smaller. With its untold depths, couldn't the sea keep alive such huge specimens of life from another age, this sea that never changes while the land masses undergo almost continuous alteration? Couldn't the heart of the ocean hide the last remaining varieties of these titanic species, for whom years are centuries and centuries millennia? But I mustn't let these fantasies run away with me. Enough of these fairy tales that time has changed for me into harsh realities. I repeat, opinion had crystallized as to the nature of this phenomenon, and the public accepted without argument the existence of a prodigious creature that had nothing in common with the fabled sea serpent. Yet if some saw it purely as a scientific problem to be solved, more practical people, especially in America and England, were determined to purge the ocean of this daunting monster, to ensure the safety of transoceanic travel. The industrial and commercial newspapers dealt with the question chiefly from this viewpoint. The Shipping and Mercantile Gazette, the Lloyd's List, France's Packet Boat and Maritime and Colonial Review, all the rags devoted to insurance companies, who threatened to raise their premium rates, were unanimous on this point. Public opinion being pronounced, the states of the Union were the first in the field. In New York, preparations were underway for an expedition designed to chase this narwhal. A high-speed frigate, the Abraham Lincoln, was fitted out for putting to sea as soon as possible. The naval arsenals were unlocked for Commander Farragut, who pressed energetically forward with the arming of his frigate. But, as it always happens, just when a decision had been made to chase the monster put in no further appearances. For 2 months nobody heard a word about it. Not a single ship encountered it. Apparently the unicorn had gotten wise to these plots being woven around it. People were constantly babbling about the creature, even via the Atlantic cable. Accordingly, the wags claimed that this slippery rascal had waylaid some passing telegram and was making the most of it. So the frigate was equipped for a far-off voyage and armed with fearsome fishing gear, but nobody knew where to steer it. And impatience grew until, on June 2, word came that the Tampico, a steamer on the San Francisco line sailing from California to Shanghai, had sighted the animal again, 3 weeks before in the northerly seas of the Pacific. This news caused intense excitement. Not even a 24-hour breather was granted to Commander Farragut. His provisions were loaded on board. His coal bunkers were overflowing. Not a crewman was missing from his post. To cast off, he needed only to fire and stoke his furnaces. Half a day's delay would have been unforgivable. But Commander Farragut wanted nothing more than to go forth. I received a letter 3 hours before the Abraham Lincoln left its Brooklyn pier. The letter read as follows. Author's note, appears a type of wharf expressly set aside for an individual vessel. Pierre Aronnax, professor at the Paris Museum, Fifth Avenue Hotel, New York. Sir. If you would like to join the expedition on the Abraham Lincoln, the government of the Union will be pleased to regard you as France's representative in this undertaking. Commander Farragut has a cabin at your disposal. Very cordially yours. J. B. Hobson, Secretary of the Navy. Chapter 3. As Master Wishes. 3 seconds before the arrival of J.B. Hobson's letter, I no more dreamed of chasing the unicorn than of trying for the Northwest Passage. 3 seconds after reading this letter from the Honorable Secretary of the Navy, I understood at last that my true vocation, my sole purpose in life, was to hunt down this disturbing monster and rid the world of it. Even so, I had just returned from an arduous journey, exhausted and badly needing a rest. I wanted nothing more than to see my country again, my friends, my modest quarters by the botanical gardens, my dearly beloved collections. But now nothing could hold me back. I forgot everything else, and without another thought of exhaustion, friends, or collections, I accepted the American government's offer. Besides, I mused, all roads lead home to Europe, and our unicorn may be gracious enough to take me toward the coast of France. That fine animal may even let itself be captured in European seas, as a personal favor to me, and I'll bring back to the Museum of Natural History at least half a meter of its ivory lance. But in the meantime I would have to look for this narwhal in the northern Pacific Ocean, which meant returning to France by way of the Antipodes. Conseil. I called in an impatient voice. Conseil was my manservant. A devoted lad who went with me on all my journeys, a gallant Flemish boy whom I genuinely liked and who returned the compliment, a born stoic, punctilious on principle, habitually hard-working, rarely startled by life's surprises, very skillful with his hands, efficient in his every duty, and despite his having a name that means counsel, never giving advice, not even the unsolicited kind. From rubbing shoulders with scientists in our little universe by the botanical gardens, the boy had come to know a thing or two. In Conseil I had a seasoned specialist in biological classification, an enthusiast who could run with acrobatic agility up and down the whole ladder of branches, groups, classes, subclasses, orders, families, genera, subgenera, species, and varieties. But there his science came to a halt. Classifying was everything to him, so he knew nothing else. Well versed in the theory of classification, he was poorly versed in its practical application, and I doubt that he could tell a sperm whale from a baleen whale. And yet, what a fine, gallant lad. For the past 10 years, Conseil had gone with me wherever science beckoned. Not once did he comment on the length or the hardships of a journey. Never did he object to buckling up his suitcase for any country whatever, China or the Congo, no matter how far off it was. He went here, there, and everywhere in perfect contentment. Moreover, he enjoyed excellent health that defied all ailments, owned solid muscles, but hadn't a nerve in him, not a sign of nerves, the mental type, I mean. The lad was 30 years old, and his age to that of his employer was as 15 as to 20. Please forgive me for this underhanded way of admitting I had turned 40. But Conseil had one flaw. He was a fanatic on formality, and he only addressed me in the third person, to the point where it got tiresome. Conseil. I repeated, while feverishly beginning my preparations for departure. To be sure, I had confidence in this devoted lad. Ordinarily, I never asked whether or not it suited him to go with me on my journeys, but this time an expedition was at issue that could drag on indefinitely, a hazardous undertaking whose purpose was to hunt an animal that could sink a frigate as easily as a walnut shell. There was good reason to stop and think, even for the world's most emotionless man. What would Conseil say? Conseil. I called a third time. Conseil appeared. Did Master summon me? He said, entering. Yes, my boy. Get my things ready, get yours ready. We're departing in 2 hours. As Master wishes, Conseil replied serenely. We haven't a moment to lose. Pack as much into my trunk as you can, my traveling kit, my suits, shirts, and socks, don't bother counting, just squeeze it all in, and hurry. What about Master's collections? Conseil ventured to observe. We'll deal with them later. What? The Archaeotherium, Hyracotherium, Oreodonts, Carapotamus, and Master's other fossil skeletons? The hotel will keep them for us. What about Master's live babirusa? They'll feed it during our absence. Anyhow, we'll leave instructions to ship the whole menagerie to France. Then we aren't returning to Paris? Conseil asked. Yes, we are. Certainly, I replied evasively, but after we make a detour. Whatever detour Master wishes. Oh, it's nothing really. A route slightly less direct, that's all. We're leaving on the Abraham Lincoln. As Master thinks best, Conseil replied placidly. You see, my friend, it's an issue of the monster, the notorious narwhal. We're going to rid the seas of it. The author of a 2-volume work, in quarto, on the mysteries of the great ocean depths has no excuse for not setting sail with Commander Farragut. It's a glorious mission but also a dangerous one. We don't know where it will take us. These beasts can be quite unpredictable. But we're going just the same. We have a commander who's game for anything. What Master does, I'll do, Conseil replied. But think it over, because I don't want to hide anything from you. This is one of those voyages from which people don't always come back. As Master wishes. A quarter of an hour later, our trunks were ready. Kinsey did them in a flash, and I was sure the lad hadn't missed a thing, because he classified shirts and suits as expertly as birds and mammals. The hotel elevator dropped us off in the main vestibule on the mezzanine. I went down a short stair leading to the ground floor. I settled my bill at that huge counter that was always under siege by a considerable crowd. I left instructions for shipping my containers of stuffed animals and dried plants to Paris, France. I opened a line of credit sufficient to cover the Barbarossa and, Kinsey at my heels, I jumped into a carriage. For a fare of 20 francs, the vehicle went down Broadway to Union Square, took 4th Avenue to its junction with Bowery Street, turned into Catherine Street and halted at Pier 34. There the Catherine ferry transferred men, horses, and carriage to Brooklyn, that great New York annex located on the left bank of the East River, and in a few minutes we arrived at the wharf next to which the Abraham Lincoln was vomiting torrents of black smoke from its two funnels. Our baggage was immediately carried to the deck of the frigate. I rushed aboard. I asked for Commander Farragut. One of the sailors led me to the afterdeck, where I stood in the presence of a smart-looking officer who extended his hand to me. "Professor Pierre Aronnax?" he said to me. "The same," I replied. "Commander Farragut?" "In person. Welcome aboard, Professor. Your cabin is waiting for you." I bowed, and letting the commander attend to getting underway, I was taken to the cabin that had been set aside for me. The Abraham Lincoln had been perfectly chosen and fitted out for its new assignment. It was a high-speed frigate furnished with superheating equipment that allowed the tension of its steam to build to 7 atmospheres. Under this pressure the Abraham Lincoln reached an average speed of 18.3 miles per hour, a considerable speed but still not enough to cope with our gigantic cetacean. The frigate's interior accommodations complemented its nautical virtues. I was well satisfied with my cabin, which was located in the stern and opened into the officer's mess. "We'll be quite comfortable here," I told Kinsey. "With all due respect to Master," Kinsey replied, "as comfortable as a hermit crab inside the shell of a whelk." I left Kinsey to the proper stowing of our luggage and climbed on deck to watch the preparations for getting underway. Just then Commander Farragut was giving orders to cast off the last moorings holding the Abraham Lincoln to its Brooklyn pier. And so if I'd been delayed by a quarter of an hour or even less, the frigate would have gone without me, and I would have missed out on this unearthly, extraordinary, and inconceivable expedition, whose true story might well meet with some skepticism. But Commander Farragut didn't want to waste a single day, or even a single hour, in making for those seas where the animal had just been sighted. He summoned his engineer. "Are we up to pressure?" he asked the man. "Aye, sir," the engineer replied. "Go ahead, then," Commander Farragut called. At this order, which was relayed to the engine by means of a compressed air device, the mechanics activated the startup wheel. Steam rushed whistling into the gaping valves. Long horizontal pistons groaned and pushed the tie rods of the drive shaft. The blades of the propeller churned the waves with increasing speed, and the Abraham Lincoln moved out majestically amid a spectator-laden escort of some 100 ferries and tenders. Author's note: tenders are small steamboats that assist the big liners. The wharves of Brooklyn, and every part of New York bordering the East River, were crowded with curiosity seekers. Departing from 500,000 throats, three cheers burst forth in succession. Thousands of handkerchiefs were waving above these tightly packed masses, hailing the Abraham Lincoln until it reached the waters of the Hudson River, at the tip of the long peninsula that forms New York City. The frigate then went along the New Jersey coast, the wonderful right bank of this river, all loaded down with country homes, and passed by the forts to salutes from their biggest cannons. The Abraham Lincoln replied by three times lowering and hoisting the American flag, whose 39 stars gleamed from the gaff of the mizzen sail, then, changing speed to take the buoy-marked channel that curved into the inner bay formed by the spit of Sandy Hook, it hugged this sand-covered strip of land where thousands of spectators acclaimed us one more time. The escort of boats and tenders still followed the frigate and only left us when we came abreast of the lightship, whose two signal lights marked the entrance of the Narrows to Upper New York Bay. 3 o'clock then sounded. The harbor pilot went down into his dinghy and rejoined a little schooner waiting for him to leeward. The furnaces were stoked, the propeller churned the waves more swiftly, the frigate skirted the flat, yellow coast of Long Island, and at 8 o'clock in the evening, after the lights of Fire Island had vanished into the northwest, we ran at full steam onto the dark waters of the Atlantic. Chapter 4. Ned Land. Commander Farragut was a good seaman, worthy of the frigate he commanded. His ship and he were one. He was its very soul. On the cetacean question no doubts arose in his mind, and he didn't allow the animal's existence to be disputed aboard his vessel. He believed in it as certain pious women believe in the Leviathan from the book of Job, out of faith, not reason. The monster existed, and he had vowed to rid the seas of it. The man was a sort of Knight of Rhodes, a latter-day Sir Dieudonné of Gozo, on his way to fight an encounter with the dragon devastating the island. Either Commander Farragut would slay the narwhal, or the narwhal would slay Commander Farragut. No middle of the road for these two. The ship's officers shared the views of their leader. They could be heard chatting, discussing, arguing, calculating the different chances of an encounter, and observing the vast expanse of the ocean. Voluntary watches from the crosstrees of the topgallant sail were self-imposed by more than one who would have cursed such toil under any other circumstances. As often as the sun swept over its daily arc, the masts were populated with sailors whose feet itched and couldn't hold still on the planking of the deck below. And the Abraham Lincoln's stempost hadn't even cut the suspected waters of the Pacific. As for the crew, they only wanted to encounter the unicorn, harpoon it, haul it on board, and carve it up. They surveyed the sea with scrupulous care. Besides, Commander Farragut had mentioned that a certain sum of $2,000 was waiting for the man who first sighted the animal, be he cabin boy or sailor, mate or officer. I'll let the reader decide whether I's got proper exercise aboard the Abraham Lincoln. As for me, I didn't lag behind the others and I yielded to no one my share in these daily observations. Our frigate would have had 50 good reasons for renaming itself the Argus, after that mythological beast with 100 eyes. The lone rebel among us was Conseil, who seemed utterly uninterested in the question exciting us and was out of step with the general enthusiasm on board. As I said, Commander Farragut had carefully equipped his ship with all the gear needed to fish for a gigantic cetacean. No whaling vessel could have been better armed. We had every known mechanism, from the hand-hurled harpoon, to the blunderbuss firing barbed arrows, to the duck gun with exploding bullets. On the forecastle was mounted the latest model breech-loading cannon, very heavy of barrel and narrow of bore, a weapon that would figure in the Universal Exhibition of 1867. Made in America, this valuable instrument could fire a 4-kilogram conical projectile an average distance of 16 kilometers without the least bother. So the Abraham Lincoln wasn't lacking in means of destruction. But it had better still. It had Ned Land, the king of harpooners. Gifted with uncommon manual ability, Ned Land was a Canadian who had no equal in his dangerous trade. Dexterity, coolness, bravery, and cunning were virtues he possessed to a high degree, and it took a truly crafty baleen whale or an exceptionally astute sperm whale to elude the thrusts of his harpoon. Ned Land was about 40 years old. A man of great height, over 6 English feet, he was powerfully built, serious in manner, not very sociable, sometimes headstrong, and quite ill-tempered when crossed. His looks caught the attention, and above all the strength of his gaze, which gave a unique emphasis to his facial appearance. Commander Farragut, to my thinking, had made a wise move in hiring on this man. With his eye and his throwing arm, he was worth the whole crew all by himself. I can do no better than to compare him with a powerful telescope that could double as a cannon always ready to fire. To say Canadian is to say French, and as unsociable as Ned Land was, I must admit he took a definite liking to me. No doubt it was my nationality that attracted him. It was an opportunity for him to speak, and for me to hear, that old Rabelaisian dialect still used in some Canadian provinces. The harpooner's family originated in Quebec, and they were already a line of bold fishermen back in the days when this town still belonged to France. Little by little Ned developed a taste for chatting, and I loved hearing the tales of his adventures in the polar seas. He described his fishing trips and his battles with great natural lyricism. His tales took on the form of an epic poem, and I felt I was hearing some Canadian Homer reciting his Iliad of the high Arctic regions. I'm writing of this bold companion as I currently know him. Because we've become old friends, united in that permanent comradeship born and cemented during only the most frightful crises. Ah, my gallant Ned. I ask only to live 100 years more, the longer to remember you. And now, what were Ned Land's views on this question of a marine monster? I must admit that he flatly didn't believe in the unicorn, and alone on board, he didn't share the general conviction. He avoided even dealing with the subject, for which one day I felt compelled to take him to task. During the magnificent evening of June 25, in other words, 3 weeks after our departure, the frigate lay abreast of Cabo Blanco, 30 miles to leeward of the coast of Patagonia. We had crossed the Tropic of Capricorn, and the Strait of Magellan opened less than 700 miles to the south. Before 8 days were out, the Abraham Lincoln would plow the waves of the Pacific. Seated on the afterdeck, Ned Land and I chatted about one thing and another, staring at that mysterious sea whose depths to this day are beyond the reach of human eyes. Quite naturally, I led our conversation around to the giant unicorn, and I weighed our expedition's various chances for success or failure. Then, seeing that Ned just let me talk without saying much himself, I pressed him more closely. "Ned," I asked him, "how can you still doubt the reality of this cetacean we're after? Do you have any particular reasons for being so skeptical?" The harpooner stared at me a while before replying, slapped his broad forehead in one of his standard gestures, closed his eyes as if to collect himself, and finally said, "Just maybe, Professor Aronnax." "But Ned, you're a professional whaler, a man familiar with all the great marine mammals, your mind should easily accept this hypothesis of an enormous cetacean, and you ought to be the last one to doubt it under these circumstances." "That's just where you're mistaken, Professor," Ned replied. "The common man may still believe in fabulous comets crossing outer space, or in prehistoric monsters living at the Earth's core, but astronomers and geologists don't swallow such fairy tales. It's the same with whalers. I've chased plenty of cetaceans, I've harpooned a good number, I've killed several. But no matter how powerful and well-armed they were, neither their tails or their tusks could puncture the sheet iron plates of a steamer." "Even so, Ned, people mention vessels that narwhal tusks have run clean through." "Wooden ships maybe," the Canadian replied. "But I've never seen the like. So till I have proof to the contrary, I'll deny that baleen whales, sperm whales, or unicorns can do any such thing."
"Listen to me, Ned."
"No, no, Professor. I'll go along with anything you want except that. Some gigantic devilfish maybe?"
"Even less likely, Ned. The devilfish is merely a mollusk, and even this name hints at its semi-liquid flesh, because it's Latin meaning soft one. The devilfish doesn't belong to the vertebrate branch, and even if it were 500 feet long, it would still be utterly harmless to ships like the Scotia or the Abraham Lincoln. Consequently, the feats of krakens or other monsters of that ilk must be relegated to the realm of fiction."
"So, Mr. Naturalist," Ned Land continued in a bantering tone, "you'll just keep on believing in the existence of some enormous cetacean?"
"Yes, Ned, I repeat it with a conviction backed by factual logic. I believe in the existence of a mammal with a powerful constitution, belonging to the vertebrate branch like baleen whales, sperm whales, or dolphins, and armed with a tusk made of horn that has tremendous penetrating power."
"Humphrey," the harpooner put in, shaking his head with the attitude of a man who doesn't want to be convinced.
"Note well, my fine Canadian," I went on, "if such an animal exists, if it lives deep in the ocean, if it frequents the liquid strata located miles beneath the surface of the water, it needs to have a constitution so solid, it defies all comparison."
"And why this powerful constitution?" Ned asked.
"Because it takes incalculable strength just to live in those deep strata and withstand their pressure."
"Oh really?" Ned said, tipping me a wink.
"Oh really, and I can prove it to you with a few simple figures."
"Bosh," Ned replied. "You can make figures do anything you want."
"In business, Ned, but not in mathematics. Listen to me. Let's accept that the pressure of one atmosphere is represented by the pressure of a column of water 32 feet high. In reality, such a column of water wouldn't be quite so high because here we're dealing with salt water, which is denser than fresh water. Well then, when you dive under the waves, Ned, for every 32 feet of water above you, your body is tolerating the pressure of one more atmosphere, in other words, one more kilogram per each square centimeter on your body's surface. So it follows that at 320 feet down, this pressure is equal to 10 atmospheres, to 100 atmospheres at 3,200 feet, and to 1,000 atmospheres at 32,000 feet, that is, at about 2.5 vertical leagues down. Which is tantamount to saying that if you could reach such a depth in the ocean, each square centimeter on your body's surface would be experiencing 1,000 kilograms of pressure. Now, my gallant Ned, do you know how many square centimeters you have on your bodily surface?" "I haven't the foggiest notion, Professor Aronnax."
"About 17,000.
"As many as that?"
"Yes, and since the atmosphere's pressure actually weighs slightly more than 1 kilogram per square centimeter, your 17,000 square centimeters are tolerating 17,568 kilograms at this very moment."
"Without my noticing it?"
"Without your noticing it. And if you aren't crushed by so much pressure, it's because the air penetrates the interior of your body with equal pressure. When the inside and outside pressures are in perfect balance, they neutralize each other and allow you to tolerate them without discomfort. But in the water it's another story."
"Yes, I see," Ned replied, growing more interested. Because the water surrounds me but doesn't penetrate me. Precisely, Ned. So at 32 feet beneath the surface of the sea, you'll undergo a pressure of 17,568 kilograms. At 320 feet, or 10 times greater pressure, it's 175,680 kilograms. At 3,200 feet, or 100 times greater pressure, it's 1,756,800 kilograms. Finally, at 32,000 feet, or 1,000 times greater pressure, it's 17,568,000 kilograms. In other words, you'd be squashed as flat as if you'd just been yanked from between the plates of a hydraulic press. Fire and brimstone, Ned put in. All right then, my fine harpooner, if vertebrates several hundred meters long and proportionate in bulk live at such depths, their surface areas make up millions of square centimeters, and the pressure they undergo must be assessed in billions of kilograms. Calculate, then, how much resistance of bone structure and strength of constitution they'd need in order to withstand such pressures. They'd need to be manufactured, Ned Land replied, from sheet iron plates 8 inches thick, like ironclad frigates. Right, Ned, and then picture the damage such a mass could inflict if it were launched with the speed of an express train against a ship's hull. Yes. Indeed. Maybe, the Canadian replied, staggered by these figures but still not willing to give in. Well, have I convinced you? You've convinced me of one thing, Mr. Naturalist. That deep in the sea, such animals would need to be just as strong as you say, if they exist. But if they don't exist, my stubborn harpooner, how do you explain the accident that happened to the Scotia? It's maybe, Ned said, hesitating. Go on. Because. It just couldn't be true. The Canadian replied, unconsciously echoing a famous catchphrase of the scientist Arago. But this reply proved nothing, other than how bullheaded the harpooner could be. That day I pressed him no further. The Scotia's accident was undeniable. Its hull was real enough that it had to be plugged up, and I don't think a hull's existence can be more emphatically proven. Now then, this hull didn't make itself, and since it hadn't resulted from underwater rocks or underwater machines, it must have been caused by the perforating tool of some animal. Now, for all the reasons put forward to this point, I believe that this animal was a member of the branch Vertebrate, class Mammalia, group Pisciforma, and finally, order Cetacea. As for the family in which it would be placed, baleen whale, sperm whale, or dolphin, the genus to which it belonged, and the species in which it would find its proper home, these questions had to be left for later. To answer them called for dissecting this unknown monster, to dissect it called for catching it, to catch it called for harpooning it, which was Ned Land's business, to harpoon it called for sighting it, which was the crew's business, and to sight it called for encountering it, which was a chancy business. Chapter 5. At random. For some while the voyage of the Abraham Lincoln was marked by no incident. But one circumstance arose that displayed Ned Land's marvelous skills and showed just how much confidence we could place in him. Off the Falkland Islands on June 30th, the frigate came in contact with a fleet of American whalers, and we learned that they hadn't seen the narwhal. But one of them, the captain of the Monroe, knew that Ned Land had shipped aboard the Abraham Lincoln and asked his help in hunting a baleen whale that was in sight. Anxious to see Ned Land at work, Commander Farragut authorized him to make his way aboard the Monroe. And the Canadian had such good luck that with a right and left shot, he harpooned not one whale but two, striking the first straight to the heart and catching the other after a few minutes' chase. Assuredly, if the monster ever had to deal with Ned Land's harpoon, I wouldn't bet on the monster. The frigate sailed along the east coast of South America with prodigious speed. By July 3rd we were at the entrance to the Strait of Magellan, abreast of Cabo de las Virgenes. But Commander Farragut was unwilling to attempt this tortuous passageway and maneuvered instead to double Cape Horn. The crew sided with him unanimously. Indeed, were we likely to encounter the narwhal in such a cramped strait? Many of our sailors swore that the monster couldn't negotiate this passageway simply because he's too big for it. Near 3 o'clock in the afternoon on July 6, 15 miles south of shore, the Abraham Lincoln doubled that solitary islet at the tip of the South American continent. That stray rock Dutch seamen had named Cape Horn after their hometown of Horn. Our course was set for the northwest, and the next day our frigate's propeller finally churned the waters of the Pacific. Open your eyes. Open your eyes. Repeated the sailors of the Abraham Lincoln. And they opened amazingly wide. Eyes and spyglasses, a bit dazzled, it is true, by the vista of $2,000, didn't remain at rest for an instant. Day and night we observed the surface of the ocean, and those with nyctalopic eyes, whose ability to see in the dark increased their chances by 50%, had an excellent shot at winning the prize. As for me, I was hardly drawn by the lure of money and yet was far from the least attentive on board. Snatching only a few minutes for meals and a few hours for sleep, come rain or come shine, I no longer left the ship's deck. Sometimes bending over the forecastle railings, sometimes leaning against the stern rail, I eagerly scoured the cotton-colored wake that whitened the ocean as far as the eye could see. And how many times I shared the excitement of general staff and crew when some unpredictable whale lifted its blackish back above the waves. In an instant the frigate's deck would become densely populated. The cows over the companionways would vomit a torrent of sailors and officers. With panting chests and anxious eyes, we each would observe the cetacean's movements. I stared until I nearly went blind from a worn-out retina, while Conseil, as stoic as ever, kept repeating to me in a calm tone. If Master's eyes would kindly stop bulging, Master will see farther. But what a waste of energy. The Abraham Lincoln would change course and race after the animal sighted, only to find an ordinary baleen whale or a common sperm whale that soon disappeared amid a chorus of curses. However, the weather held good. Our voyage was proceeding under the most favorable conditions. By then it was the bad season in these southernmost regions, because July in this zone corresponds to our January in Europe, but the sea remained smooth and easily visible over a vast perimeter. Ned Land still kept up the most tenacious skepticism. Beyond his spells on watch, he pretended that he never even looked at the surface of the waves, at least while no whales were in sight. And yet the marvelous power of his vision could have performed yeoman service. But this stubborn Canadian spent 8 hours out of every 12 reading or sleeping in his cabin. 100 times I chided him for his unconcern. "Bah," he replied. "Nothing's out there, Professor Aronnax, and if there is some animal, what chance would we have of spotting it? Can't you see we're just wandering around at random? People say they've sighted this slippery beast again in the Pacific high seas. I'm truly willing to believe it, but 2 months have already gone by since then, and judging by your narwhal's personality, it hates growing moldy from hanging out too long in the same waterways. It's blessed with a terrific gift for getting around. Now, Professor, you know even better than I that nature doesn't violate good sense, and she wouldn't give some naturally slow animal the ability to move swiftly if it hadn't a need to use that talent. So if the beast does exist, it's already long gone." I had no reply to this. Obviously we were just groping blindly. But how else could we go about it? All the same, our chances were automatically pretty limited. Yet everyone still felt confident of success, and not a sailor on board would have bet against the narwhal appearing, and soon. On July 20th we cut the Tropic of Capricorn at longitude 105 degrees, and by the 27th of the same month, we had cleared the equator on the 110th meridian. These bearings determined, the frigate took a more decisive westward heading and tackled the seas of the Central Pacific. Commander Farragut felt, and with good reason, that it was best to stay in deep waters and keep his distance from continents or islands, whose neighborhoods the animal always seemed to avoid, no doubt, our bosun said, because there isn't enough water for him. So the frigate kept well out when passing the Tuamotu, Marquesas, and Hawaiian Islands, then cut the Tropic of Cancer at longitude 132 degrees and headed for the seas of China. We were finally in the area of the monster's latest antics. And in all honesty, shipboard conditions became life-threatening. Hearts were pounding hideously, gearing up for futures full of incurable aneurysms. The entire crew suffered from a nervous excitement that it's beyond me to describe. Nobody ate, nobody slept. 20 times a day some error in perception, or the optical illusions of some sailor perched in the crosstrees, would cause intolerable anguish, and this emotion, repeated 20 times over, kept us in a state of irritability so intense that a reaction was bound to follow. And this reaction wasn't long in coming. For 3 months, during which each day seemed like a century, the Abraham Lincoln plowed all the northerly seas of the Pacific, racing after whales sighted, abruptly veering off course, swerving sharply from one tack to another, stopping suddenly, putting on steam and reversing engines in quick succession, at the risk of stripping its gears, and it didn't leave a single point unexplored from the beaches of Japan to the coasts of America. And we found nothing. Nothing except an immenseness of deserted waves. Nothing remotely resembling a gigantic narwhal, or an underwater islet, or a derelict shipwreck, or a runaway reef, or anything the least bit unearthly. So the reaction set in. At first, discouragement took hold of people's minds, opening the door to disbelief. A new feeling appeared on board, made up of 3/10 shame and 7/10 fury. The crew called themselves out-and-out fools for being hoodwinked by a fairy tale, then grew steadily more furious. The mountains of arguments amassed over a year collapsed all at once, and each man now wanted only to catch up on his eating and sleeping, to make up for the time he had so stupidly sacrificed. With typical human fickleness, they jumped from one extreme to the other. Inevitably, the most enthusiastic supporters of the undertaking became its most energetic opponents. This reaction mounted upward from the bowels of the ship, from the quarters of the bunker hands to the messroom of the general staff, and for certain, if it hadn't been for Commander Farragut's characteristic stubbornness, the frigate would ultimately have put back to that cape in the south. But this futile search couldn't drag on much longer. The Abraham Lincoln had done everything it could to succeed and had no reason to blame itself. Never had the crew of an American naval craft shown more patience and zeal. They weren't responsible for this failure, there was nothing to do but go home. A request to this effect was presented to the commander. The commander stood his ground. His sailors couldn't hide their discontent, and their work suffered because of it. I'm unwilling to say that there was mutiny on board, but after a reasonable period of intransigence, Commander Farragut, like Christopher Columbus before him, asked for a grace period of just 3 days more. After this three-day delay, if the monster hadn't appeared, our helmsman would give three turns of the wheel, and the Abraham Lincoln would chart a course toward European seas. This promise was given on November 2nd. It had the immediate effect of reviving the crew's failing spirits. The ocean was observed with renewed care. Each man wanted one last look with which to sum up his experience. Spyglasses functioned with feverish energy. A supreme challenge had been issued to the giant narwhal, and the latter had no acceptable excuse for ignoring this summons to appear. 2 days passed. The Abraham Lincoln stayed at half steam. On the off chance that the animal might be found in these waterways, 1,000 methods were used to spark its interest or rouse it from its apathy. Enormous sides of bacon were trailed in our wake, to the great satisfaction, I must say, of assorted sharks. While the Abraham Lincoln heaved to, its longboats radiated in every direction around it and didn't leave a single point of the sea unexplored. But the evening of November 4th arrived with this underwater mystery still unsolved. At noon the next day, November 5th, the agreed-upon delay expired. After a position fix, true to his promise, Commander Farragut would have to set his course for the southeast and leave the northerly regions of the Pacific decisively behind. By then the frigate lay in latitude 31 degrees 15 north and longitude 136 degrees 42 east. The shores of Japan were less than 200 miles to our leeward. Night was coming on. 8 o'clock had just struck. Huge clouds covered the moon's disk, then in its first quarter. The sea undulated placidly beneath the frigate's stem post. Just then I was in the bow, leaning over the starboard rail. Conseil, stationed beside me, stared straight ahead. Roosting in the shrouds, the crew examined the horizon, which shrank and darkened little by little. Officers were probing the increasing gloom with their night glasses. Sometimes the murky ocean sparkled beneath moonbeams that darted between the fringes of two clouds. Then all traces of light vanished into the darkness. Observing Conseil, I discovered that, just barely, the gallant lad had fallen under the general influence. At least so I thought. Perhaps his nerves were twitching with curiosity for the first time in history. "Come on, Conseil," I told him. "Here's your last chance to pocket that $2,000. "If Master will permit my saying so," Conseil replied, "I never expected to win that prize, and the Union government could have promised $100,000 and been none the poorer." "You're right, Conseil, it turned out to be a foolish business after all, and we jumped into it too hastily. What a waste of time, what a futile expense of emotion. 6 months ago we could have been back in France." "In Master's little apartment," Conseil answered. "In Master's museum. And by now I would have classified Master's fossils. And Master's Babirusa would be ensconced in its cage at the zoo in the botanical gardens, and it would have attracted every curiosity seeker in town." "Quite so, Conseil, and what's more, I imagine that people will soon be poking fun at us." "To be sure," Conseil replied serenely, "I do think they'll have fun at Master's expense. And must it be said?"
"It must be said, Conseil."
"Well then, it will serve Master right."
"How true.
When one has the honor of being an expert as Master is, one mustn't lay himself open to—" Conseil didn't have time to complete the compliment. In the midst of the general silence, a voice became audible. It was Ned Land's voice, and it shouted, "Ahoy! There's the thing in question, abreast of us to leeward." Chapter 6. At full steam. At this shout the entire crew rushed toward the harpooner, commander, officers, mates, sailors, cabin boys, down to engineers leaving their machinery and stokers neglecting their furnaces. The order was given to stop, and the frigate merely coasted. By then the darkness was profound,
and as good as the Canadian's eyes were, I still wondered how he could see, and what he had seen. My heart was pounding fit to burst. But Ned Land was not mistaken, and we all spotted the object his hand was indicating. 2 cable lengths off the Abraham Lincoln's starboard quarter, the sea seemed to be lit up from underneath. This was no mere phosphorescent phenomenon, that much was unmistakable. Submerged some fathoms below the surface of the water, the monster gave off that very intense but inexplicable glow that several captains had mentioned in their reports. This magnificent radiance had to come from some force with a great illuminating capacity. The edge of its light swept over the sea in an immense, highly elongated oval, condensing at the center into a blazing core whose unbearable glow diminished by degrees outward. "It's only a cluster of phosphorescent particles," exclaimed one of the officers. "No, sir," I answered with conviction. "Not even angel wing clams or salps have ever given off such a powerful light. That glow is basically electric in nature. Besides, look, look. It's shifting. It's moving back and forth. It's starting at us." A universal shout went up from the frigate. "Quiet," Commander Farragut said. "Helm hard to leeward. Reverse engines." Sailors rushed to the helm, engineers to their machinery. Under reverse steam immediately, the Abraham Lincoln beat to port, sweeping in a semicircle. "Right your helm. Engines forward," Commander Farragut called. These orders were executed, and the frigate swiftly retreated from this core of light. My mistake. It wanted to retreat, but the unearthly animal came at us with a speed double our own. We gasped. More stunned than afraid, we stood mute and motionless. The animal caught up with us, played with us. It made a full circle around the frigate, then doing 14 knots, and wrapped us in sheets of electricity that were like luminous dust. Then it retreated 2 or 3 miles, leaving a phosphorescent trail comparable to those swirls of steam that shoot behind the locomotive of an express train. Suddenly, all the way from the dark horizon where it had gone to gather momentum, the monster abruptly dashed toward the Abraham Lincoln with frightening speed, stopped sharply 20 feet from our side plates, and died out, not by diving under the water, since its glow did not recede gradually, but all at once, as if the source of this brilliant emanation had suddenly dried up. Then it reappeared on the other side of the ship, either by circling around us or by gliding under our hull. At any instant a collision could have occurred that would have been fatal to us. Meanwhile I was astonished at the frigate's maneuvers. It was fleeing, not fighting. Built to pursue, it was being pursued, and I commented on this to Commander Farragut. His face, ordinarily so emotionless, was stamped with indescribable astonishment. "Professor Aronnax," he answered me, "I don't know what kind of fearsome creature I'm up against, and I don't want my frigate running foolish risks in all this darkness. Besides, how should we attack this unknown creature? How should we defend ourselves against it? Let's wait for daylight, and then we'll play a different role." "You've no further doubts, Commander, as to the nature of this animal?" "No, sir, it's apparently a gigantic narwhal, and an electric one to boot." "Maybe," I added, "it's no more approachable than an electric eel or an electric ray." "Right," the commander replied. "And if it has their power to electrocute, it's surely the most dreadful animal ever conceived by our creator. That's why I'll keep on my guard, sir." The whole crew stayed on their feet all night long. No one even thought of sleeping. Unable to compete with the monster's speed, the Abraham Lincoln slowed down and stayed at half steam. For its part, the narwhal mimicked the frigate, simply rode with the waves, and seemed determined not to forsake the field of battle. However, near midnight it disappeared, or to use a more appropriate expression, it went out, like a huge glowworm. Had it fled from us? We were duty-bound to fear so rather than hope so. But at 12:53 in the morning, a deafening hiss became audible, resembling the sound made by a waterspout expelled with tremendous intensity. By then Commander Farragut, Ned Land, and I were on the afterdeck, peering eagerly into the profound gloom. "Ned Land," the commander asked, "you've often heard whales bellowing?" "Often, sir, but never a whale like this, whose sighting earned me $2,000. "Correct, the prize is rightfully yours. But tell me, isn't that the noise cetaceans make when they spurt water from their blowholes?" "The very noise, sir, but this one's way louder. So there can be no mistake. There's definitely a whale lurking in our waters. With your permission, sir," the harpooner added, "tomorrow at daybreak we'll have words with it." "If it's in a mood to listen to you, Mr. Land," I replied in a tone far from convinced. "Let me get within 4 harpoon lengths of it," the Canadian shot back, "and it had better listen." "But to get near it," the commander went on, I'd have to put a whaleboat at your disposal?
Certainly, sir.
That would be gambling with the lives of my men.
And with my own.
The harpooner replied simply. Near 2 o'clock in the morning, the core of light reappeared, no less intense, 5 miles to windward of the Abraham Lincoln. Despite the distance, despite the noise of wind and sea, we could distinctly hear the fearsome thrashings of the animal's tail, and even its panting breath. Seemingly, the moment this enormous narwhal came up to breathe at the surface of the ocean, air was sucked into its lungs like steam into the huge cylinders of a 2,000-horsepower engine.
Hmm.
I said to myself. A cetacean as powerful as a whole cavalry regiment, now that's a whale of a whale. We stayed on the alert until daylight, getting ready for action. Whaling gear was set up along the railings. Our chief officer loaded the blunderbusses, which can launch harpoons as far as a mile, and long duck guns with exploding bullets that can mortally wound even the most powerful animals. Ned Land was content to sharpen his harpoon, a dreadful weapon in his hands. At 6 o'clock day began to break, and with the dawn's early light, the narwhal's electric glow disappeared. At 7 o'clock the day was well along, but a very dense morning mist shrank the horizon, and our best spyglasses were unable to pierce it. The outcome? Disappointment and anger. I hoisted myself up to the cross trees of the mizzen sail. Some officers were already perched on the mastheads. At 8 o'clock the mist rolled ponderously over the waves, and its huge curls were lifting little by little. The horizon grew wider and clearer all at once. Suddenly, just as on the previous evening, Ned Land's voice was audible. "There's the thing in question, astern to port," the harpooner shouted. Every eye looked toward the point indicated. There, a mile and a half from the frigate, a long blackish body emerged a meter above the waves. Quivering violently, its tail was creating a considerable eddy. Never had caudal equipment thrashed the sea with such power. An immense wake of glowing whiteness marked the animal's track, sweeping in a long curve. Our frigate drew nearer to the cetacean. I examined it with a completely open mind. Those reports from the Shannon and the Helvetia had slightly exaggerated its dimensions, and I put its length at only 250 feet. Its girth was more difficult to judge, but all in all, the animal seemed to be wonderfully proportioned in all three dimensions. While I was observing this phenomenal creature, two jets of steam and water sprang from its blowholes and rose to an altitude of 40 meters, which settled for me its mode of breathing. From this I finally concluded that it belonged to the branch Vertebrata, class Mammalia, subclass Monodelphia, group Pisciforma, order Cetacea, family. But here I couldn't make up my mind. The order Cetacea consists of three families, baleen whales, sperm whales, dolphins, and it's in this last group that narwhals are placed. Each of these families is divided into several genera, each genus into species, each species into varieties. So I was still missing variety, species, genus, and family, but no doubt I would complete my classifying with the aid of Heaven and Commander Farragut. The crew were waiting impatiently for orders from their leader. The latter, after carefully observing the animal, called for his engineer. The engineer raced over.
"Sir," the commander said, "are you up to pressure?"
"Aye, sir," the engineer replied.
"Fine. Stoke your furnaces and clap on full steam." Three cheers greeted this order. The hour of battle had sounded. A few moments later, the frigate's two funnels vomited torrents of black smoke, and its deck quaked from the trembling of its spoilers. Driven forward by its powerful propeller, the Abraham Lincoln headed straight for the animal. Unconcerned, the latter let us come within half a cable length, then, not bothering to dive, it got up a little speed, retreated, and was content to keep its distance. This chase dragged on for about 3/4 of an hour without the frigate gaining 2 fathoms on the cetacean. At this rate, it was obvious that we would never catch up with it. Infuriated, Commander Farragut kept twisting the thick tuft of hair that flourished below his chin.
"Ned Land," he called. The Canadian reported at once.
"Well, Mr. Land," the commander asked, "do you still advise putting my longboats to sea?"
"No, sir," Ned Land replied, "because that beast won't be caught against its will."
"Then what should we do?"
"Stoke up more steam, sir, if you can. As for me, with your permission I'll go perch on the bobstays under the bowsprit, and if we can get within a harpoon length, I'll harpoon the brute."
"Go to it, Ned," Commander Farragut replied.
"Engineer," he called, "keep the pressure mounting." Ned Land made his way to his post. The furnaces were urged into greater activity, our propeller did 43 revolutions per minute, and steam shot from the valves. Heaving the log,
We verified that the Abraham Lincoln was going at the rate of 18.5 miles per hour. But that damned animal also did a speed of 18.5. For the next hour our frigate kept up this pace without gaining a fathom. This was humiliating for one of the fastest racers in the American Navy. The crew were working up into a blind rage. Sailor after sailor heaved insults at the monster, which couldn't be bothered with answering back. Commander Farragut was no longer content simply to twist his goatee, he chewed on it. The engineer was summoned once again. "You're up to maximum pressure?" the commander asked him.
"Aye, sir," the engineer replied.
"And your valves are charged too?"
"To 6.5 atmospheres.
"Charge them to 10 atmospheres. A typical American order if I ever heard one. It would have sounded just fine during some Mississippi paddle wheeler race, to outstrip the competition.
"Conseil," I said to my gallant servant, now at my side, "you realize that we'll probably blow ourselves sky high?"
"As master wishes," Conseil replied.
"All right, I admit it, I did wish to run this risk."
The valves were charged. More coal was swallowed by the furnaces. Ventilators shot torrents of air over the braziers. The Abraham Lincoln's speed increased. Its masts trembled down to their blocks, and swirls of smoke could barely squeeze through the narrow funnels. We heaved the log a second time.
"Well, helmsman?" Commander Farragut asked.
19.3 miles per hour, sir.
"Keep stoking the furnaces."
The engineer did so. The pressure gauge marked 10 atmospheres. But no doubt the cetacean itself had warmed up, because without the least trouble, it also did 19.3. What a chase. No, I can't describe the excitement that shook my very being. Ned Land stayed at his post, harpoon in hand. Several times the animal let us approach.
"We're overhauling it," the Canadian would shout.
Then, just as he was about to strike, the cetacean would steal off with a swiftness I could estimate at no less than 30 miles per hour. And even at our maximum speed, it took the liberty of thumbing its nose at the frigate by running a full circle around us. A howl of fury burst from every throat. By noon we were no farther along than at 8 o'clock in the morning. Commander Farragut then decided to use more direct methods.
"Bah," he said. "So that animal is faster than the Abraham Lincoln. All right, we'll see if it can outrun our conical shells.
Mate, man the gun in the bow." Our forecastle cannon was immediately loaded and leveled. The cannoneer fired a shot, but a shell passed some feet above the cetacean, which stayed half a mile off.
"Over to somebody with better aim," the commander shouted.
"And $500 to the man who can pierce that infernal beast." Kamavai, cool of feature, an old gray-bearded gunner, I can see him to this day, approached the cannon, put it in position, and took aim for a good while. There was a mighty explosion, mingled with cheers from the crew. The shell reached its target, it hit the animal, but not in the usual fashion, it bounced off that rounded surface and vanished into the sea 2 miles out.
"Oh drat," said the old gunner in his anger. "That rascal must be covered with 6-inch armor plate."
"Curse the beast," Commander Farragut shouted. The hunt was on again, and Commander Farragut leaned over to me, saying, "I'll chase that animal till my frigate explodes."
"Yes," I replied, "and nobody would blame you.
We could still hope that the animal would tire out and not be as insensitive to exhaustion as our steam engines. But no such luck. Hour after hour went by without it showing the least sign of weariness. However, to the Abraham Lincoln's credit, it must be said that we struggled on with tireless persistence. I estimate that we covered a distance of at least 500 kilometers during this ill-fated day of November 6. But night fell and wrapped the surging ocean in its shadows. By then I thought our expedition had come to an end, that we would never see this fantastic animal again. I was mistaken. At 10:50 in the evening, that electric light reappeared 3 miles to windward of the frigate, just as clear and intense as the night before. The narwhal seemed motionless. Was it asleep perhaps, weary from its workday, just riding with the waves? This was our chance, and Commander Farragut was determined to take full advantage of it. He gave his orders. The Abraham Lincoln stayed at half steam, advancing cautiously so as not to awaken its adversary. In mid-ocean it's not unusual to encounter whales so sound asleep they can successfully be attacked, and Ned Land had harpooned more than one in its slumber. The Canadian went to resume his post on the bobstays under the bowsprit. The frigate approached without making a sound, stopped 2 cable lengths from the animal and coasted. Not a soul breathed on board. A profound silence reigned over the deck. We were not 100 feet from the blazing core of light, whose glow grew stronger and dazzled the eyes. Just then, leaning over the forecastle railing, I saw Ned land below me, one hand grasping the martingale, the other brandishing his dreadful harpoon. Barely 20 feet separated him from the motionless animal. All at once his arm shot forward and the harpoon was launched. I heard the weapon collide resonantly, as if it had hit some hard substance. The electric light suddenly went out, and two enormous waterspouts crashed onto the deck of the frigate, racing like a torrent from stem to stern, toppling crewmen, breaking spare masts and yardarms from their lashings. A hideous collision occurred, and thrown over the rail with no time to catch hold of it, I was hurled into the sea. Chapter 7. A whale of unknown species. Although I was startled by this unexpected descent, I at least have a very clear recollection of my sensations during it. At first I was dragged about 20 feet under. I'm a good swimmer, without claiming to equal such other authors as Byron and Edgar Allan Poe, who were master divers, and I didn't lose my head on the way down. With two vigorous kicks of the heel, I came back to the surface of the sea. My first concern was to look for the frigate. Had the crew seen me go overboard? Was the Abraham Lincoln tacking about? Would Commander Farragut put a longboat to sea? Could I hope to be rescued? The gloom was profound. I glimpsed a black mass disappearing eastward, where its running lights were fading out in the distance. It was the frigate. I felt I was done for. Help! Help! I shouted, swimming desperately toward the Abraham Lincoln. My clothes were weighing me down. The water glued them to my body, they were paralyzing my movements. I was sinking. I was suffocating. Help! This was the last shout I gave. My mouth was filling with water. I struggled against being dragged into the depths. Suddenly my clothes were seized by energetic hands, I felt myself pulled abruptly back to the surface of the sea, and yes, I heard these words pronounced in my ear. If Master would oblige me by leaning on my shoulder, Master will swim with much greater ease. With one hand I seized the arm of my loyal Conseil. You. I said. You. Myself, Conseil replied, and at Master's command. That collision threw you overboard along with me? Not at all. But being in Master's employ, I followed Master. The fine lad thought this only natural. What about the frigate? I asked. The frigate? Conseil replied, rolling over on his back. I think Master had best not depend on it to any great extent. What are you saying? I'm saying that just as I jumped overboard, I heard the men at the helm shout, "Our propeller and rudder are smashed." Smashed? Yes, smashed by the monster's tusk. I believe it's the sole injury the Abraham Lincoln has sustained. But most inconveniently for us, the ship can no longer steer. Then we're done for. Perhaps, Conseil replied serenely. However, we still have a few hours before us, and in a few hours one can do a great many things. Conseil's unflappable composure cheered me up. I swam more vigorously, but hampered by clothes that were as restricting as a cloak made of lead, I was managing with only the greatest difficulty. Conseil noticed as much. Master will allow me to make an incision, he said. And he slipped an open clasp knife under my clothes, slitting them from top to bottom with one swift stroke. Then he briskly undressed me while I swam for us both. I then did Conseil the same favor, and we continued to navigate side by side. But our circumstances were no less dreadful. Perhaps they hadn't seen us go overboard, and even if they had, the frigate, being undone by its rudder, couldn't return to leeward after us. So we could count only on its longboats. Conseil had coolly reasoned out this hypothesis and laid his plans accordingly. An amazing character, this boy, in mid-ocean, this stoic lad seemed right at home. So, having concluded that our sole chance for salvation lay in being picked up by the Abraham Lincoln's longboats, we had to take steps to wait for them as long as possible. Consequently, I decided to divide our energies so we wouldn't both be worn out at the same time, and this was the arrangement. While one of us lay on his back, staying motionless with arms crossed and legs outstretched, the other would swim and propel his partner forward. This towing role was to last no longer than 10 minutes, and by relieving each other in this way, we could stay afloat for hours, perhaps even until daybreak. Slim chance, but hope springs eternal in the human breast. Besides, there were two of us. Lastly, I can vouch, as improbable as it seems, that even if I had wanted to destroy all my illusions, even if I had been willing to give in to despair, I could not have done so. The cetacean had rammed our frigate at about 11 o'clock in the evening. I therefore calculated on 8 hours of swimming until sunrise. A strenuous task, but feasible, thanks to our relieving each other. The sea was pretty smooth and barely tired us. Sometimes I tried to peer through the dense gloom, which was broken only by the phosphorescent flickers coming from our movements. I stared at the luminous ripples breaking over my hands, shimmering sheets spattered with blotches of bluish-gray. It seemed as if we'd plunged into a pool of quicksilver. Near 1 o'clock in the morning, I was overcome with tremendous exhaustion. My limbs stiffened in the grip of intense cramps. Kensei had to keep me going, and attending to our self-preservation became his sole responsibility. I soon heard the poor lad gasping, his breathing became shallow and quick. I didn't think he could stand such exertions for much longer. "Go on. Go on," I told him. "Leave Master behind?" he replied. "Never. I'll drown before he does." Just then, past the fringes of a large cloud that the wind was driving eastward, the moon appeared. The surface of the sea glistened under its rays. That kindly light rekindled our strength. I held up my head again. My eyes darted to every point of the horizon. I spotted the frigate. It was 5 miles from us and formed no more than a dark, barely perceptible mass. But as for longboats, not a one in sight. I tried to call out. What was the use at such a distance? My swollen lips wouldn't let a single sound through. Kensei could still articulate a few words, and I heard him repeat at intervals. "Help! Help!" Ceasing all movement for an instant, we listened. And it may have been a ringing in my ear, from this organ filling with impeded blood, but it seemed to me that Kensei's shout had received an answer back. "Did you hear that?" I muttered. "Yes, yes." And Kensei hurled another desperate plea into space. This time there could be no mistake. A human voice had answered us. Was it the voice of some poor devil left behind in mid-ocean, some other victim of that collision suffered by our ship? Or was it one of the frigate's longboats, hailing us out of the gloom? Kensei made one final effort, and bracing his hands on my shoulders, while I offered resistance with one supreme exertion, he raised himself half out of the water, then fell back exhausted. "What did you see?" "I saw," he muttered, "I saw. But we mustn't talk save our strength." What had he seen? Then, Lord knows why, the thought of the monster came into my head for the first time. But even so, that voice gone are the days when Jonas took refuge in the bellies of whales. Nevertheless, Kensei kept towing me. Sometimes he looked up, stared straight ahead, and shouted a request for directions, which was answered by a voice that was getting closer and closer. I could barely hear it. I was at the end of my strength, my fingers gave out, my hands were no help to me, my mouth opened convulsively, filling with brine, its coldness ran through me, I raised my head one last time, then I collapsed. Just then something hard banged against me. I clung to it. Then I felt myself being pulled upward, back to the surface of the water, my chest caved in, and I fainted. For certain, I came to quickly, because someone was massaging me so vigorously it left furrows in my flesh. I half opened my eyes. "Kensei," I muttered. "Did Master ring for me?" Kensei replied. Just then, in the last light of a moon settling on the horizon, I spotted a face that wasn't Kensei's but which I recognized at once. "Ned," I exclaimed. "In person, sir, and still after his prize," the Canadian replied. "You were thrown overboard after the frigate's collision?" "Yes, Professor, but I was luckier than you, and right away I was able to set foot on this floating islet." "Islet?" "Or in other words, on our gigantic narwhal." "Explain yourself, Ned." "It's just that I soon realized why my harpoon got blunted and couldn't puncture its hide."
"Why, Ned, why?"
"Because, Professor, this beast is made of boilerplate steel. At this point in my story, I need to get a grip on myself, reconstruct exactly what I experienced, and make doubly sure of everything I write." The Canadian's last words caused a sudden upheaval in my brain. I swiftly hoisted myself to the summit of this half-submerged creature or object that was serving as a refuge. I tested it with my foot. Obviously it was some hard, impenetrable substance, not the soft matter that makes up the bodies of our big marine mammals. But this hard substance could have been a bony carapace, like those that covered some prehistoric animals, and I might have left it at that and classified this monster among such amphibious reptiles as turtles or alligators. Well, no. The blackish back supporting me was smooth and polished with no overlapping scales. On impact, it gave off a metallic sonority, and as incredible as this sounds, it seemed, I swear, to be made of riveted plates. No doubts were possible. This animal, this monster, this natural phenomenon that had puzzled the whole scientific world, that had muddled and misled the minds of seamen in both hemispheres,
was, there could be no escaping it, an even more astonishing phenomenon, a phenomenon made by the hand of man. Even if I had discovered that some fabulous, mythological creature really existed, it wouldn't have given me such a terrific mental jolt. It's easy enough to accept that prodigious things can come from our Creator. But to find, all at once, right before your eyes, that the impossible had been mysteriously achieved by man himself, this staggers the mind. But there was no question now. We were stretched out on the back of some kind of underwater boat that, as far as I could judge, boasted the shape of an immense steel fish. Ned Land had clear views on the issue. Conseil and I could only line up behind him. "But then," I said, "does this contraption contain some sort of locomotive mechanism, and a crew to run it?" "Apparently," the harpooner replied. "And yet for the 3 hours I've lived on this floating island, it hasn't shown a sign of life." "This boat hasn't moved at all?" "No, Professor Aronnax. It just rides with the waves, but otherwise it hasn't stirred. But we know that it's certainly gifted with great speed. Now then, since an engine is needed to generate that speed, and a mechanic to run that engine, I conclude, we're saved."
"Humphrey," Ned Land put in, his tone denoting reservations. Just then, as if to take my side in the argument, a bubbling began astern of this strange submersible, whose drive mechanism was obviously a propeller, and the boat started to move. We barely had time to hang on to its topside, which emerged about 80 centimeters above water. Fortunately, its speed was not excessive. "So long as it navigates horizontally," Ned Land muttered, "I've no complaints. But if it gets the urge to dive, I wouldn't give $2 for my hide." The Canadian might have quoted a much lower price. So it was imperative to make contact with whatever beings were confined inside the plating of this machine. I searched its surface for an opening or a hatch, a manhole, to use the official term, but the lines of rivets had been firmly driven into the sheet iron joins and were straight and uniform. Moreover, the moon then disappeared and left us in profound darkness. We had to wait for daylight to find some way of getting inside this underwater boat. So our salvation lay totally in the hands of the mysterious helmsman steering this submersible, and if it made a dive, we were done for. But aside from this occurring, I didn't doubt the possibility of our making contact with them. In fact, if they didn't produce their own air, they inevitably had to make periodic visits to the surface of the ocean to replenish their oxygen supply. Hence the need for some opening that put the boat's interior in contact with the atmosphere. As for any hope of being rescued by Commander Farragut, that had to be renounced completely. We were being swept westward, and I estimate that our comparatively moderate speed reached 12 miles per hour. The propeller churned the waves with mathematical regularity, sometimes emerging above the surface and throwing phosphorescent spray to great heights. Near 4 o'clock in the morning, the submersible picked up speed. We could barely cope with this dizzying rush, and the waves battered us at close range. Fortunately, Ned's hands came across a big mooring ring fastened to the top side of this sheet iron back, and we all held on for dear life. Finally, this long night was over. My imperfect memories won't let me recall my every impression of it. A single detail comes back to me. Several times, during various lulls of wind and sea, I thought I heard indistinct sounds, a sort of elusive harmony produced by distant musical chords. What was the secret behind this underwater navigating, whose explanation the whole world had sought in vain? What beings lived inside this strange boat? What mechanical force allowed it to move about with such prodigious speed? Daylight appeared. The morning mists surrounded us, but they soon broke up. I was about to proceed with a careful examination of the hull, whose topside formed a sort of horizontal platform, when I felt it sinking little by little. "Oh, damnation!" Ned Land shouted, stamping his foot on the resonant sheet iron. "Open up there, you antisocial navigators!" But it was difficult to make yourself heard above the deafening beats of the propeller. Fortunately, this submerging movement stopped. From inside the boat, there suddenly came noises of iron fastenings pushed roughly aside. One of the steel plates flew up, a man appeared, gave a bizarre yell, and instantly disappeared. A few moments later, 8 strapping fellows appeared silently, their faces like masks, and dragged us down into their fearsome machine. Chapter 8. Mobilis in Mobili. This brutally executed capture was carried out with lightning speed. My companions and I had no time to collect ourselves. I don't know how they felt about being shoved inside this aquatic prison, but as for me, I was shivering all over. With whom were we dealing? Surely with some new breed of pirates, exploiting the sea after their own fashion. The narrow hatch had barely closed over me when I was surrounded by profound darkness. Saturated with the outside light, my eyes couldn't make out a thing.
I felt my naked feet clinging to the steps of an iron ladder. Forcibly seized, Ned Land and Kinsey were behind me. At the foot of the ladder, a door opened and instantly closed behind us with a loud clang. We were alone. Where? I couldn't say, could barely even imagine. All was darkness, but such utter darkness that after several minutes, my eyes were still unable to catch a single one of those hazy gleams that drift through even the blackest nights. Meanwhile, furious at these goings-on, Ned Land gave free rein to his indignation. "Damnation!" he exclaimed. "These people are about as hospitable as the savages of New Caledonia. All that's lacking is for them to be cannibals. I wouldn't be surprised if they were, but believe you me, they won't eat me without my kicking up a protest." "Calm yourself, Ned my friend," Kinsey replied serenely. "Don't flare up so quickly. We aren't in a kettle yet." "In a kettle, no," the Canadian shot back, "but in an oven for sure. It's dark enough for one. Luckily my Bowie knife hasn't left me, and I can still see well enough to put it to use. The first one of these bandits who lays a hand on me." Author's note: a Bowie knife is a wide-bladed dagger that Americans are forever carrying around. "Don't be so irritable, Ned," I then told the harpooner, "and don't ruin things for us with pointless violence. Who knows whether they might be listening to us? Instead, let's try to find out where we are." I started moving, groping my way. After five steps I encountered an iron wall made of riveted boilerplate. Then, turning around, I bumped into a wooden table next to which several stools had been set. The floor of this prison lay hidden beneath thick, hempen matting that deadened the sound of footsteps. Its naked walls didn't reveal any trace of a door or window. Going around the opposite way, Kinsey met up with me, and we returned to the middle of this cabin, which had to be 20 feet long by 10 wide. As for its height, not even Ned Land, with his great stature, was able to determine it. Half an hour had already gone by without our situation changing, when our eyes were suddenly spirited from utter darkness into blinding light. Our prison lit up all at once, in other words, it filled with luminescent matter so intense that at first I couldn't stand the brightness of it. From its glare and whiteness, I recognized the electric glow that had played around this underwater boat like some magnificent phosphorescent phenomenon. After involuntarily closing my eyes, I reopened them and saw that this luminous force came from a frosted half-globe curving out of the cabin's ceiling. "Finally! It's light enough to see!" Ned Land exclaimed, knife in hand, staying on the defensive. "Yes," I replied, then ventured the opposite view. "But as for our situation, we're still in the dark." "Master must learn patience," said the emotionless Kinsey. This sudden illumination of our cabin enabled me to examine its tiniest details. It contained only a table and five stools. Its invisible door must have been hermetically sealed. Not a sound reached our ears. Everything seemed dead inside this boat. Was it in motion, or stationary on the surface of the ocean, or sinking into the depths? I couldn't tell. But this luminous globe hadn't been turned on without good reason. Consequently, I hoped that some crewman would soon make an appearance. If you want to consign people to oblivion, you don't light up their dungeons. I was not mistaken. Unlocking noises became audible, a door opened, and two men appeared. One was short and stocky, powerfully muscled, broad-shouldered, robust of limbs, the head squat, the hair black and luxuriant, the mustache heavy, the eyes bright and penetrating, and his whole personality stamped with that southern-blooded zest that, in France, typifies the people of Provence. The philosopher Diderot has very aptly claimed that a man's bearing is the clue to his character, and this stocky little man was certainly a living proof of this claim. You could sense that his everyday conversation must have been packed with such vivid figures of speech as personification, symbolism, and misplaced modifiers. But I was never in a position to verify this because, around me, he used only an odd and utterly incomprehensible dialect. The second stranger deserves a more detailed description. A disciple of such character judging anatomist as Gratiolet or Engel could have read this man's features like an open book. Without hesitation, I identified his dominant qualities, self-confidence, since his head reared like a nobleman's above the arc formed by the lines of his shoulders, and his black eyes gazed with icy assurance, calmness, since his skin, pale rather than ruddy, indicated tranquility of blood, energy, shown by the swiftly knitting muscles of his brow, and finally courage, since his deep breathing denoted tremendous reserves of vitality. I might add that this was a man of great pride, that his calm, firm gaze seemed to reflect thinking on an elevated plane, and that the harmony of his facial expressions and bodily movements resulted in an overall effect of unquestionable candor, according to the findings of physiognomists, those analysts of facial character.
I felt involuntarily reassured in his presence, and this boded well for our interview. Whether this individual was 35 or 50 years of age, I could not precisely state. He was tall, his forehead broad, his nose straight, his mouth clearly etched, his teeth magnificent, his hands refined, tapered, and to use a word from palmistry, highly psychic, in other words, worthy of serving a lofty and passionate spirit. This man was certainly the most wonderful physical specimen I had ever encountered. One unusual detail, his eyes were spaced a little far from each other and could instantly take in nearly a quarter of the horizon. This ability, as I later verified, was strengthened by a range of vision even greater than Ned Land's. When this stranger focused his gaze on an object, his eyebrow lines gathered into a frown, his heavy eyelids closed around his pupils to contract his huge field of vision, and he looked. What a look, as if he could magnify objects shrinking into the distance, as if he could probe your very soul, as if he could pierce those sheets of water so opaque to our eyes and scan the deepest seas. Wearing caps made of sea otter fur, and shod in sealskin fishing boots, these two strangers were dressed in clothing made from some unique fabric that flattered the figure and allowed great freedom of movement. The taller of the two, apparently the leader on board, examined us with the greatest care but without pronouncing a word. Then, turning to his companion, he conversed with him in a language I didn't recognize. It was a sonorous, harmonious, flexible dialect whose vowels seemed to undergo a highly varied accentuation. The other replied with a shake of the head and added two or three utterly incomprehensible words. Then he seemed to question me directly with a long stare. I replied in clear French that I wasn't familiar with his language, but he didn't seem to understand me, and the situation grew rather baffling. Still, Master should tell our story, Kinsey said to me. Perhaps these gentlemen will grasp a few words of it. I tried again, telling the tale of our adventures, clearly articulating my every syllable, and not leaving out a single detail. I stated our names and titles, then, in order, I introduced Professor Aronnax, his manservant Kinsey, and Mr. Ned Land, harpooner. The man with calm, gentle eyes listened to me serenely, even courteously, and paid remarkable attention. But nothing in his facial expression indicated that he understood my story. When I finished, he didn't pronounce a single word. One resource still left was to speak English. Perhaps they would be familiar with this nearly universal language. But I only knew it, as I did the German language, well enough to read it fluently, not well enough to speak it correctly. Here, however, our overriding need was to make ourselves understood. "Come on, it's your turn," I told the harpooner. "Over to you, Mr. Land. Pull out of your bag of tricks the best English ever spoken by an Anglo-Saxon, and try for a more favorable result than mine." Ned needed no persuading and started our story all over again, most of which I could follow. Its content was the same, but the form differed. Carried away by his volatile temperament, the Canadian put great animation into it. He complained vehemently about being imprisoned in defiance of his civil rights, asked by virtue of which law he was hereby detained, invoked writs of habeas corpus, threatened to press charges against anyone holding him in illegal custody, ranted, gesticulated, shouted, and finally conveyed by an expressive gesture that we were dying of hunger. This was perfectly true, but we had nearly forgotten the fact. Much to his amazement, the harpooner seemed no more intelligible than I had been. Our visitors didn't bat an eye. Apparently they were engineers who understood the languages of neither the French physicist Arago nor the English physicist Faraday. Thoroughly baffled after vainly exhausting our philological resources, I no longer knew what tactic to pursue, when Kinsey told me. "If Master will authorize me, I'll tell the whole business in German." "What? You know German?" I exclaimed. "Like most Flemish people, with all due respect to Master. On the contrary, my respect is due you. Go to it, my boy." And Kinsey, in his serene voice, described for the third time the various vicissitudes of our story. But despite our narrator's fine accent and stylish turns of phrase, the German language met with no success. Finally, as a last resort, I hauled out everything I could remember from my early school days, and I tried to narrate our adventures in Latin. Cicero would have plugged his ears and sent me to the scholarly, but somehow I managed to pull through. With the same negative result. This last attempt ultimately misfiring, the two strangers exchanged a few words in their incomprehensible language and withdrew, not even favoring us with one of those encouraging gestures that are used in every country in the world. The door closed again. "This is outrageous," Ned Land shouted, exploding for the 20th time. "I ask you. We speak French, English, German,
and Latin to these rogues, and neither of them has the decency to even answer back.
Calm down, Ned, I told the seething harpooner. Anger won't get us anywhere.
But Professor, our irascible companion went on, can't you see that we could die of hunger in this iron cage?
Bah. Conseil put in philosophically. We can hold out a good while yet.
My friends, I said, we mustn't despair. We've gotten out of tighter spots. So please do me the favor of waiting a bit before you form your views on the commander and crew of this boat.
My views are fully formed, Ned Land shot back. They're rogues.
Oh good. And from what country?
Roguedom.
My gallant Ned, as yet that country isn't clearly marked on maps of the world, but I admit that the nationality of these two strangers is hard to make out. Neither English, French, nor German, that's all we can say. But I'm tempted to think that the commander and his chief officer were born in the low latitudes. There must be southern blood in them. But as to whether they're Spaniards, Turks, Arabs, or East Indians, their physical characteristics don't give me enough to go on. And as for their speech, it's utterly incomprehensible.
That's the nuisance in not knowing every language, Conseil replied, or the drawback in not having one universal language.
Which would all go out the window. Ned Land replied. Don't you see? These people have a language all to themselves, a language they've invented just to cause despair in decent people who ask for a little dinner.
Why, in every country on earth, when you open your mouth, snap your jaws, smack your lips and teeth, isn't that the world's most understandable message? From Quebec to the Tuamotu Islands, from Paris to the Antipodes, doesn't it mean, I'm hungry, give me a bite to eat?
Oh, Conseil put in, there are some people so unintelligent by nature.
As he was saying these words, the door opened. A steward entered. He brought us some clothes, jackets and sailor's pants, made out of a fabric whose nature I didn't recognize. I hurried to change into them, and my companions followed suit.
Author's note, a steward is a waiter on board a steamer.
Meanwhile our silent steward, perhaps a deaf mute, set the table and laid three place settings.
There's something serious afoot, Conseil said, and it bodes well.
Bah. Replied the rancorous harpooner. What the devil do you suppose they eat around here? Turtle livers, loin of shark, dogfish steaks?
We'll soon find out. Conseil said. Overlaid with silver dish covers, various platters had been neatly positioned on the tablecloth, and we sat down to eat. Assuredly, we were dealing with civilized people, and if it hadn't been for this electric light flooding over us, I would have thought we were in the dining room of the Hotel Adelphi in Liverpool, or the Grand Hotel in Paris. However, I feel compelled to mention that bread and wine were totally absent. The water was fresh and clear, but it was still water, which wasn't what Ned Land had in mind. Among the foods we were served, I was able to identify various daintily dressed fish, but I couldn't make up my mind about certain otherwise excellent dishes, and I couldn't even tell whether their contents belonged to the vegetable or the animal kingdom. As for the tableware, it was elegant and in perfect taste. Each utensil, spoon, fork, knife, and plate, bore on its reverse a letter encircled by a Latin motto, and here is its exact duplicate. Mobilis in mobili en. Moving within the moving element. It was a highly appropriate motto for this underwater machine, so long as the preposition in is translated as within and not upon. The letter N was no doubt the initial of the name of that mystifying individual in command beneath the seas. Ned and Conseil had no time for such musings. They were wolfing down their food, and without further ado I did the same. By now I felt reassured about our fate, and it seemed obvious that our hosts didn't intend to let us die of starvation. But all earthly things come to an end, all things must pass, even the hunger of people who haven't eaten for 15 hours. Our appetites appeased, we felt an urgent need for sleep. A natural reaction after that interminable night of fighting for our lives.
Ye gods, I'll sleep soundly, Conseil said.
Me, I'm out like a light. Ned Land replied.
My two companions lay down on the cabin's carpeting and were soon deep in slumber. As for me, I gave in less readily to this intense need for sleep. Too many thoughts had piled up in my mind, too many insoluble questions had arisen, too many images were keeping my eyelids open. Where were we? What strange power was carrying us along? I felt, or at least I thought I did, the submersible sinking toward the sea's lower strata. Intense nightmares besieged me. In these mysterious marine sanctuaries, I envisioned hosts of unknown animals, and this underwater boat seemed to be a blood relation of theirs, living, breathing, just as fearsome. Then my mind grew calmer, my imagination melted into hazy drowsiness, and I soon fell into an uneasy slumber.
Chapter 9.
The tantrums of Ned Land. I have no idea how long this slumber lasted, but it must have been a good while, since we were completely over our exhaustion. I was the first one to wake up. My companions weren't yet stirring and still lay in their corners like inanimate objects. I had barely gotten up from my passably hard mattress when I felt my mind clear, my brain go on the alert. So I began a careful re-examination of our cell. Nothing had changed in its interior arrangements. The prison was still a prison and its prisoners still prisoners. But, taking advantage of our slumber, the steward had cleared the table. Consequently, nothing indicated any forthcoming improvement in our situation, and I seriously wondered if we were doomed to spend the rest of our lives in this cage. This prospect seemed increasingly painful to me because, even though my brain was clear of its obsessions from the night before, I was feeling an odd short-windedness in my chest. It was becoming hard for me to breathe. The heavy air was no longer sufficient for the full play of my lungs. Although our cell was large, we obviously had used up most of the oxygen it contained. In essence, over an hour's time a single human being consumes all the oxygen found in 100 liters of air, at which point that air has become charged with a nearly equal amount of carbon dioxide and is no longer fit for breathing. So it was now urgent to renew the air in our prison, and no doubt the air in this whole underwater boat as well. Here a question popped into my head. How did the commander of this aquatic residence go about it? Did he obtain air using chemical methods, releasing the oxygen contained in potassium chlorate by heating it, meanwhile absorbing the carbon dioxide with potassium hydroxide? If so, he would have to keep up some kind of relationship with the shore, to come by the materials needed for such an operation. Did he simply limit himself to storing the air in high-pressure tanks and then dispense it according to his crew's needs? Perhaps. Or, proceeding in a more convenient, more economical, and consequently more probable fashion, was he satisfied with merely returning to breathe at the surface of the water like a cetacean, renewing his oxygen supply every 24 hours? In any event, whatever his method was, it seemed prudent to me that he use this method without delay. In fact, I had already resorted to speeding up my inhalations in order to extract from the cell what little oxygen it contained, when suddenly I was refreshed by a current of clean air, scented with a salty aroma. It had to be a sea breeze, life-giving and charged with iodine. I opened my mouth wide, and my lungs glutted themselves on the fresh particles. At the same time, I felt a swaying, a rolling of moderate magnitude but definitely noticeable. This boat, this sheet iron monster, had obviously just risen to the surface of the ocean, there to breathe in good whale fashion. So the ship's mode of ventilation was finally established. When I had absorbed a chestful of this clean air, I looked for the conduit, the air carrier, if you prefer, that allowed this beneficial influx to reach us, and I soon found it. Above the door opened an air vent that let in a fresh current of oxygen, renewing the thin air in our cell. I had gotten to this point in my observations when Ned and Kinsey woke up almost simultaneously, under the influence of this reviving air purification. They rubbed their eyes, stretched their arms, and sprang to their feet. "Did Master sleep well?" Kinsey asked me with his perennial good manners. "Extremely well, my gallant lad," I replied. "And how about you, Mr. Ned Land?" "Like a log, Professor. But I must be imagining things, because it seems like I'm breathing a sea breeze." A seaman couldn't be wrong on this topic, and I told the Canadian what had gone on while he slept. "Good," he said. "That explains perfectly all that bellowing we heard, when our so-called narwhal lay in sight of the Abraham Lincoln." "Perfectly, Mr. Land. It was catching its breath. Only I've no idea what time it is, Professor Aronnax, unless maybe it's dinner time?" "Dinner time, my fine harpooner? I'd say at least breakfast time, because we've certainly woken up to a new day." "Which indicates," Kinsey replied, "that we've spent 24 hours in slumber." "That's my assessment," I replied. "I won't argue with you," Ned Land answered. "But dinner or breakfast, that steward will be plenty welcome whether he brings the one or the other." "The one and the other," Kinsey said. "Well put," the Canadian replied. "We deserve two meals, and speaking for myself, I'll do justice to them both." "All right, Ned, let's wait and see," I replied. "It's clear that these strangers don't intend to let us die of hunger, otherwise last evening's dinner wouldn't make any sense." "Unless they're fattening us up," Ned shot back. "I object," I replied. "We have not fallen into the hands of cannibals." "Just because they don't make a habit of it," the Canadian replied in all seriousness, "doesn't mean they don't indulge from time to time. Who knows? Maybe these people have gone without fresh meat for a long while, and in that case three healthy,
well-built specimens like the professor, his manservant, and me.
Get rid of those ideas, Mr. Land, I answered the harpooner. And above all, don't let them lead you to flare up against our hosts, which would only make our situation worse.
Anyhow, the harpooner said, I'm as hungry as all Hades, and dinner or breakfast, not one puny meal has arrived.
Mr. Land, I answered, we have to adapt to the schedule on board, and I imagine our stomachs are running ahead of the chief cook's dinner bell.
Well then, we'll adjust our stomachs to the chef's timetable. Conseil replied serenely.
There you go again, Conseil my friend. The impatient Canadian shot back. You never allow yourself any displays of bile or attacks of nerves. You're everlastingly calm. You'd say you're after meal grace even if you didn't get any food for your before meal blessing, and you'd starve to death rather than complain.
What good would it do? Conseil asked.
Complaining doesn't have to do good, it just feels good. And if these pirates, I say pirates out of consideration for the professor's feelings, since he doesn't want us to call them cannibals, if these pirates think they're going to smother me in this cage without hearing what cuss words spice up my outbursts, they've got another thing coming.
Look here, Professor Aronnax, speak frankly. How long do you figure they'll keep us in this iron box?
To tell the truth, friend Land, I know little more about it than you do. But in a nutshell, what do you suppose is going on?
My supposition is that sheer chance has made us privy to an important secret. Now then, if the crew of this underwater boat have a personal interest in keeping that secret, and if their personal interest is more important than the lives of three men, I believe that our very existence is in jeopardy. If such is not the case, then at the first available opportunity, this monster that has swallowed us will return us to the world inhabited by our own kind.
Unless they recruit us to serve on the crew, Conseil said, and keep us here.
Till the moment, Ned Land answered, when some frigate that's faster or smarter than the Abraham Lincoln captures this den of buccaneers, then hangs all of us by the neck from the tip of a mainmast yardarm.
Well thought out, Mr. Land, I replied. But as yet, I don't believe we've been tendered any enlistment offers. Consequently, it's pointless to argue about what tactics we should pursue in such a case. I repeat, let's wait, let's be guided by events, and let's do nothing, since right now there's nothing we can do.
On the contrary, Professor, the harpooner replied, not wanting to give in. There is something we can do.
Oh? And what, Mr. Land?
Break out of here.
Breaking out of a prison on shore is difficult enough, but with an underwater prison, it strikes me as completely unworkable.
Come now, Ned my friend, Conseil asked, how would you answer Master's objection? I refuse to believe that an American is at the end of his tether.
Visibly baffled, the harpooner said nothing. Under the conditions in which fate had left us, it was absolutely impossible to escape. But a Canadian's wit is half French, and Mr. Ned Land made this clear in his reply.
So, Professor Aronnax, he went on after thinking for a few moments, you haven't figured out what people do when they can't escape from their prison?
No, my friend.
Easy. They fix things so they stay there.
Of course. Conseil put in. Since we're deep in the ocean, being inside this boat is vastly preferable to being above it or below it.
But we fix things by kicking out all the jailers, guards, and wardens, Ned Land added.
What's this, Ned? I asked. You'd seriously consider taking over this craft?
Very seriously, the Canadian replied.
It's impossible.
And why is that, sir?
Some promising opportunity might come up, and I don't see what could stop us from taking advantage of it. If there are only about 20 men on board this machine, I don't think they can stave off two Frenchmen and a Canadian.
It seemed wiser to accept the harpooner's proposition than to debate it. Accordingly, I was content to reply.
Let such circumstances come, Mr. Land, and we'll see. But until then, I beg you to control your impatience. We need to act shrewdly, and your flare-ups won't give rise to any promising opportunities. So swear to me that you'll accept our situation without throwing a tantrum over it.
I give you my word, Professor, Ned Land replied in an unenthusiastic tone. No vehement phrases will leave my mouth, no vicious gestures will give my feelings away, not even when they don't feed us on time.
I have your word, Ned, I answered the Canadian.
Then our conversation petered out, and each of us withdrew into his own thoughts. For my part, despite the harpooner's confident talk, I admit that I entertained no illusions. I had no faith in those promising opportunities that Ned Land mentioned. To operate with such efficiency, this underwater boat had to have a sizable crew, so if it came to a physical contest,
we would be facing an overwhelming opponent. Besides, before we could do anything, we had to be free, and that we definitely were not. I didn't see any way out of this sheet iron, hermetically sealed cell. And if the strange commander of this boat did have a secret to keep, which seemed rather likely, he would never give us freedom of movement aboard his vessel. Now then, would he resort to violence in order to be rid of us, or would he drop us off one day on some remote coast? There lay the unknown. All these hypotheses seemed extremely plausible to me, and to hope for freedom through use of force, you had to be a harpooner. I realized, moreover, that Ned Land's brooding was getting him madder by the minute. Little by little, I heard those aforesaid cuss words welling up in the depths of his gullet, and I saw his movements turn threatening again. He stood up, pacing in circles like a wild beast in a cage, striking the walls with his foot and fist. Meanwhile the hours passed, our hunger nagged unmercifully, and this time the steward did not appear. Which amounted to forgetting our castaway status for much too long, if they really had good intentions toward us. Tortured by the growling of his well-built stomach, Ned Land was getting more and more riled, and despite his word of honor, I was in real dread of an explosion when he stood in the presence of one of the men on board. For two more hours Ned Land's rage increased. The Canadian shouted and pleaded, but to no avail. The sheet iron walls were deaf. I didn't hear a single sound inside this dead-seeming boat. The vessel hadn't stirred, because I obviously would have felt its hull vibrating under the influence of the propeller. It had undoubtedly sunk into the watery deep and no longer belonged to the outside world. All this dismal silence was terrifying. As for our neglect, our isolation in the depths of this cell, I was afraid to guess at how long it might last. Little by little, hopes I had entertained after our interview with the ship's commander were fading away. The gentleness of the man's gaze, the generosity expressed in his facial features, the nobility of his bearing, all vanished from my memory. I saw this mystifying individual anew for what he inevitably must be, cruel and merciless. I viewed him as outside humanity, beyond all feelings of compassion, the implacable foe of his fellow man, toward whom he must have sworn an undying hate. But even so, was the man going to let us die of starvation, locked up in this cramped prison, exposed to those horrible temptations to which people are driven by extreme hunger? This grim possibility took on a dreadful intensity in my mind, and fired by my imagination, I felt an unreasoning terror run through me. Conseil stayed calm. Ned Land bellowed. Just then a noise was audible outside. Footsteps rang on the metal tiling. The locks were turned, the door opened, the steward appeared. Before I could make a single movement to prevent him, the Canadian rushed at the poor man, threw him down, held him by the throat. The steward was choking in the grip of those powerful hands. Conseil was already trying to loosen the harpooner's hands from his half-suffocated victim, and I had gone to join in the rescue, when I was abruptly nailed to the spot by these words pronounced in French. "Calm down, Mr. Land. And you, Professor, kindly listen to me." Zero Chapter 10. The Man of the Waters. It was the ship's commander who had just spoken. At these words Ned Land stood up quickly. Nearly strangled, the steward staggered out at a signal from his superior, but such was the commander's authority aboard his vessel, not one gesture gave away the resentment that this man must have felt toward the Canadian. In silence we waited for the outcome of this scene. Conseil, in spite of himself, seemed almost fascinated. I was stunned. Arms crossed, leaning against a corner of the table, the commander steadied us with great care. Was he reluctant to speak further? Did he regret those words he had just pronounced in French? You would have thought so. After a few moments of silence, which none of us would have dreamed of interrupting. "Gentlemen," he said in a calm, penetrating voice, "I speak French, English, German, and Latin with equal fluency. Hence I could have answered you as early as our initial interview, but first I wanted to make your acquaintance and then think things over. Your four versions of the same narrative, perfectly consistent by and large, established your personal identities for me. I now know that sheer chance has placed in my presence Professor Pierre Aronnax, specialist in